Welcome to the AlphaList podcast. I am your host, Toby. AlphaList is a closed community with over 400 CTOs who share their knowledge and experience in a Slack space and at events. With this podcast, we want to give our members and interested parties insights into the thoughts and ideas of top CTOs. If you're interested in becoming a member of the community, please visit alphalist.com to find out more on how to apply. This episode is kindly supported by Fastly, the biggest challenger in the CDN market. Fastly is pushing ahead the technical boundaries and is, from my perspective, the best solution on the market. Fastly is known as one of the key drivers of the edge cloud movement. Well-known customers of Fastly are Shopify, the New York Times, Reddit, GitHub, and many, many more. If you want to try it all with first-class support, just go to fastly.com/alphalist. Welcome to the AlphaList podcast. I'm your host, Toby, and today I have a great guest from Paris. Olivier is the CTO of BlaBlaCar, the biggest ride-sharing service on the planet. They are active in 22 countries, have 100 million users, over 400 million in funding, acquired 12 other ride-sharing companies. That's a huge thing. Olivier, anything to add from your side?
Yeah, sure. Hello, Tobias. So something personal. So I'm 40. I have three kids, two daughters. Very happy to be here. Thanks for having me.
So first question, BlaBlaCar. Where does that name come from?
So it's actually a fun story. It's when we started building the service, there was a question of like, okay, some people like to talk a lot in the car. Some people like to have a very quiet trip. And so as part of the user profile, we put, you could specify whether you were blah, like, I want to be quiet, blah, blah, or blah, blah, blah. I want to chat for the whole trip. And so that's part of the story there. I'm very much on the blah side, but some people like to chat all along their trip.
Yeah, I'm also the blah person. So,
well, in introverts, I guess that's not a surprise.
Maybe you can elaborate a bit more on your nerd path. So how did you get into computing? Was it like pushed by your parents, or when did you start and why?
I think it started with a Mac SE in 1986. And at the time it was, interestingly, because the Mac was never super well known for gaming, but it was through games, like maybe some of the people listening remember like Dark Castle or some of those very old school games and Fool's Errand, etc. Like I spent a lot of time, I think, on that computer as a like 6, 7, 8 year old boy. And then essentially I was studying engineering in the like late 90s, early 2000s. And that was the point in time where Apple was moving from, had bought Next and was moving to the macOS 10 version of the operating system, which kind of made it much easier to open the hood and see what was going on below the surface. You didn't have to buy a compiler, an IDE, extra, and a lot of that was available on the platform. And so I started tinkering, and I think like, yeah, there was this like wow moment of like, oh, it's actually quite easy to write code. It's quite easy to learn how to write code, and you can do things pretty quickly. You can do things and automate things. You can like start building things very easily. And I think at that point I was lost for every other industry. Like I knew I was going to be doing that kind of thing for a living. And so, yeah, like I think the rest is just more of that like piling on, and it's like, okay, like let's do computer science as part of the engineering school. Let's do an internship at Apple as part of the graduation, extra, extra.
So you're an Apple fanboy.
I can't deny I am. So I worked 13 years at Apple, and yes, I don't know that I'll ever be able to use an Android device, and that's okay. I frequently use them, but as my personal device, like, yes, I still have an iPhone.
So that was still the time when remote work was hard, right? So you worked in California, really, at Apple. What did you do there?
So right at the end of university, I had to do an internship. I was very interested. I wanted to see what Apple was like from the inside. And so I got an internship in California working on localization and all the localization tools for macOS. At the time, like, there was no iPhone. It was 2004. There was no iPhone. There were no iPads, Apple Watch. None of that existed. I spent 3 months there, like, just like looking at what was happening. And then I came back to France. And I was hired by a small team in France. Apple had a small R&D team in France that was doing iCal, iSync. So iSync at the time was like about synchronizing the user data between the Mac and other smartphones like Sony Ericsson, Symbian, Nokia. Like it was a completely different era. Like, but that was what smartphones were at the time. And so so that was 2005. I spent 7 years there, and then I moved to California, still staying at Apple, took a different job, and was in California from 2012 to 2017, mostly working on, like, as part of the operating systems team, with everything related to iCloud. Between 2004 and 2012, like, the world had evolved quite a lot, and 2012, what syncing the user's data was about was real, like, okay, sync it with iCloud and have all the users' devices, all the Apple users' devices have the same data, whether it's like iPhone, iPad, the Mac, extra.
So that was then also still on device sync and not the web interface of iCloud, right?
Correct. My team was responsible for some of the parts of the operating system that were interacting with the servers, so I actually, until I left Apple, I was really just on the client side, on the operating systems part. I had never written a line of server code until 2017.
I hope you accepted stock options as part of your salary back then.
Yeah. I think that, well, I was just lucky, I think, because, like, joining Apple in 2004, 2005, like, none of what happened in the following 15 years was written. It was the company was already kind of like recovering and was not the on the verge of bankruptcy. Like the iTunes was there, the iPod was there, and had, like, given a lot of oxygen to Apple. But obviously, like, a lot of things were still to be done. So yeah, I had some. It wasn't a stock option. It was like free shares. But yes, and the weirdest part is, like, since I got them as a French citizen working in France, like, the French law requires you to keep those super long, which in that case was a great thing. Like, I couldn't sell them, and that was probably, like, the best thing that could happen to me, is, like, not being able to sell them. I think I was just lucky there, not startup lucky, but still. Look.
Okay, cool. So one thing that is, I think, special about Apple and working at Apple is that they have a very special culture, right? You don't know too much about how it is to work for Apple. So I'd be curious what you, like, how it was and what you actually learned there.
It's interesting because, like, what you said is absolutely true. Like, Apple doesn't want to, is not super public about how they build software, how they operate internally, how they're organized, extra. That's changing a tiny bit recently. And I've seen, like, for instance, like Joel Polny, the dean of Apple University, has published some articles about, like, the organization and what kind of leaders are looking for, extra. But it's still, like, kind of a secret, and pretty explicitly so. Like, it's like, no, like, we're not going to tell everyone, like, what's how we work internally. And so you don't have any of the, it goes both way. Like, there's not much that comes out at from Apple in terms of, like, processes, tooling, extra, and also, like, the tools and the processes that have, like, emerged in the past 15 years haven't really influenced how Apple does. Like, Agile is not a thing at Apple. Like, I heard about it first in 2017 when I left Apple, all of that. And so it's like, it's always interesting to reflect on that. But one thing that's super important, I think, to remember when you look at Apple is that Apple essentially is on the 1 year, like, rhythm. Like, they have one huge release in September, October to support the new hardware. There's a much smaller, like, mid-year release around spring. If you stretch it, maybe there are four feature releases per year, but they're not shipping software, like, multiple times a day like my teams do today at Blackar. And so it changes completely how you're going to be building software if you know that from a pure pragmatic perspective, like, there's no way Apple is going to upgrade, like, the user's devices multiple times a day. So, like, that's not changing. And it's kind of an annoyance for the user, of, like, even if they try to push this and, like, okay, like, every week on Sunday evening, like, there's a new update that might change things, might break things, etc. So, like, I don't think Apple is even interested in, like, going in that direction of, like, okay, let's ship software as fast as we can. But then you need to adapt your processes and how you think about building new features, testing new features, quality, to that reality, which, again, I think is super different from what many startups or many software companies are experiencing and can experience. It's not like black or white. Like, there are very important things that you can do if you can iterate very fast, that Apple can't do. So again, like, choose how you want to ship software, and it will tell you a lot about, like, what process you should put in place. And in the case of Apple, yeah, I think they made a very strong choice to not ship often. And so, in turn, what does it mean in terms of, like, internal culture, internal, like, both engineering culture, but also, like, product design culture. Like, you're not, if you want to do an A/B test, you will have the results in 6 months. And so it's like, well, maybe you should develop a stronger view of, like, what exactly you want for your users than having to wait for 6 months to get those results, extra, extra. I think what I've seen at Apple, so you were asking, what did I learn? I think I learned the power of, like, kind of, like, that discipline, both, like, ruthless prioritization, typically in that yearly release, like, so that yearly release shipping in September and August, that release is not moving. Like, no matter what happens, like, it will ship on the day that's been decided. And it's driven by hardware, driven by, like, okay, what is the date that the next iPhone will be ready, and so all along the year, like, the features that are being built and are being integrated in the OS, like, we're looking at them and saying, like, okay, is this going to be ready for September? And if not, like, let's pull the plug now and make sure that we don't, like, paint ourselves in the corner and end up with a feature that's not ready and that could, like, either block the release or that we would have to ship in a state that's not acceptable. And so every 2 months there was, like this kind of like review and were features that people had been like working super hard that were super important to the overall strategy were like, no, this doesn't pass the bar. It's not, it should be more mature at this point in the year. We are pulling the plug. It will ship in the following release. So it's not like wasted effort, but it's very much like, no, we can't, we need to have this high bar and this ruthless discipline term like prioritization and making sure that the projects are on track or we'll pull the plug.
Who is pulling the plug? I mean, who decides that something is not?
Typically, it's going to be so. I think the deciders there are for the important features, like the ones that had a lot of spotlight extra, were Craig Federighi, the SVP for software. And there's one person that I really enjoyed working with that's less public. Her name is Kim Forat, and she was running. There's been a few articles on what she's been building in terms of like processes and frameworks as part of the first iPhones, and that was then scaled to all like macOS, iOS, etc. She was, I think, right now she's probably like a VP of program at Apple. And so in charge of like organizing those huge releases and making sure like all the engineering teams are able to converge them, etc.
And is it a very top-down culture? I mean, that is how I would see it from the outside, but I'm not sure if this is true.
It doesn't feel that way. I think it's... it depends what you're working on. I think there's a fair amount of flexibility for the teams to push some of the ideas they've had, to test things, to even sometimes like add like features into the DOS. But I think if you look at like really the most important features, the one that require a lot of teams to work together, the ones that are like front and centers in the Apple keynotes, like yes, like those like require a lot of like a lot of alignment, a lot of like a discipline again in terms of like execution, extra. And so yeah, I think. But and why I say it doesn't feel that way, I think, is like everyone is super aligned on the company mission. Everyone is super excited to be working on software that's shipping to like a billion users. And so it doesn't feel like I never felt it as, oh my God, this is top down. I can't do what I like to do, because what I was being asked to do was what I enjoyed. And so in that context, it doesn't feel really top down.
And I think it was also like back at that time, still the aura of the great leader that was somehow killing all discussions, right? I can imagine that it was in a way like this. I mean, look at iCal back then when it looked like the Jetstream interface. It was horrible. I can imagine that like a few people internally thought, okay, I don't know. But Steve decided this, so it's no problem.
Yeah, I know if that's how I would put it. I think there were some internal debates, and again, like at some point, someone needs to decide, especially on matter of taste. Like there is like, okay, like we all have an opinion, and so I think it helps to have someone deciding in those cases. And again, like I don't think about the Apple culture as killing discussions. It's more about like the arguments were made and were being discussed, and yes, at the end of the day there is a decision and everyone will move along. I think it's more Amazon like kind of like articulated it as like disagree and commit. I think I look at it kind of the same way of like, sure, like let's disagree, let's have that argument, let's discuss together. But at the end of the day, we need everyone to commit to the final decision. And I think it was very similar at Apple.
Okay. Coming from Apple, maybe a bit to your company and Blackhar, as you call it. So one thing I find particularly interesting looking at your funding amount and like the number of acquisitions and so on, I guess it's like a roll-up strategy. How is this paying back at the end? I mean, it's really like, I think you're earning like small shares of each in each ride, which is nice. But yeah, how's the plan for that? I mean, is it, it's a bit like a private equity play, right? But I don't really, like, just looking at it briefly, I don't understand it fully.
So maybe starting from the scratch and maybe kind of describing what we do, because like I think some people, when they hear ride sharing, think Uber or things like that. And so we're in a completely different world. We're mid to long distance, so typically like 80 to 800 kilometers. And essentially we allow like private drivers, like I'm going from Hamburg to Berlin with my car on Friday evening. And so I'm leaving at 6. I'm going to publish my trip on BlaBlaCar. And then passengers can see that I have available seats and book a seat in my car. They can pay online, and then as a driver, I'll get the payment. BlaBlaCar keeps a fee on the transaction, and essentially that's how the ride sharing part works. I think what so interestingly, and this is public information, but like in 2018 we were profitable. So it's not like we're not trying to do an Uber playbook of try and grow as fast as possible and at any cost. Like we've been actually building that strategy over multiple years, like growing the market. Making sure that we had the right amount of liquidity between drivers and passengers on the carpool side, and then monetizing it extra. So that's actually been working very well for us. I think in terms of acquisition, and you mentioned 12 companies that we've acquired, there's really been two waves. There's been like the kind of like expanding to new geographies wave, where we did acquire like before in 2013 to 2017, and like kind of like the ride sharing leader on that like mid to long distance segment in the different countries that we were expanding into. And the play here was really to acquire like smart people that had like the that shared our vision. And then like have all the users go to the platform that had been developed by the BlaBlaCar team, but still have like kind of the smart leaders in each country, like keep pushing that carpooling vision, that like zero empty seat, let's help drivers share their cost vision. More recently, and that's since I joined, like, we have been evolving how we think about ourselves in the long run, moving from we are a carpool company to no, like even though we're the leader on this like long distance ride sharing business, what passengers are looking for is to go from point A to point B. And so we have competition, which is like buses, train, and kind of like any other modes of transportation that's available on that kind of distance. And so that's why we entered the bus market. We acquired WeBus in France. We acquired Bus4 in Russia and Ukraine. And there, like the play was very different. This is really about expanding in this new bus opportunity and becoming a multimodal company. And so we've kept the teams and we integrated them. We're integrating the systems, extra, extra. So those are very different type of playbooks that we deployed in those different cases. In terms of overall equity story, like, well, today it's easy to get funding. And so I think this is not just specific about us, but like, it's like, do we need to become public to fund ourselves? And at this point, like, no, it's actually quite easy. We have a lot of growth and we're able to get a lot of inbound interest from investors and funds. And so I think we might do this at some point in the future, but when we're ready and on our own terms. But again, like, I think that's where, like, having the discipline to build your vision year over year, like step by step, and accepting that it will take some time. Like, you don't digest a like 100 person organization in 2 months, and it takes time to build the right processes, to build the connection, to build the like both people connection and systems connection. And so, like, having that discipline and having that long-term view of like, okay, we are going, this is the direction we're going, and we'll go there step by step. This is what step 1, 2, and 3 look like. This is where we should be in 12 months. This is where we want to be in 3 months. And this is how it connects with our long-term vision of like where we want to be in 2025, essentially.
So it's you can apply what you learned at Apple, I guess, then. It's a bit comparable because like ride sharing looks a bit boring from the outside sometimes, right? And I mean, if you look at Apple's products these days, I'm always surprised. I mean, I still buy them, even if I think, yeah, okay, this iPhone doesn't change a lot, right? It's a bit comparable.
The way I look at it is like, each incremental improvement is small, but if you sum them up over 2-3 years and you compare like the most recent iPhone with the iPhone that was first released in 2018 or 2019, like, you're like, wow, like, actually, like, those make a difference in many different directions, like quality of the camera, like the screen, like extra. And so, yeah, I think it's easy to just look at the like incremental steps, and probably us as engineers, as nerds, like, that's what we do, because we're like, whoa, I know exactly what the last year's iPhone looked like and I can compare them. But like most normal people, quote unquote, aren't doing that. They have a phone, and then they go to a store and they compare the new phones with the one they have in their hand. And I think that's a very different experience. I think it's like, oh yes, in 2, 3, 4 years, like, a lot of things have changed, and that makes actually quite a gap in terms of like user experience and product.
Yeah, I think looking at ride sharing, then, like, that you enter the details for your ride in an app, that you actually use an app instead of your computer and so on. That's like also like small steps in the last 10 years, I would say, from like still calling a number to get a cab to just using an app, right? That really changed a lot. Maybe before we continue on the product side, one more business question. So I guess then, like, your KPIs are kind of monthly active users, LTV, MRR, and so on. And you calculate revenue per user and stuff like that. One maybe a bit direct question is, if you're profitable, at what MRR range, like broad range, are you then?
So we were profitable in 2018, and since then, like, we decided to enter the bus market, and so we're back in a very much an investment phase of like building this new market, becoming multimodal, extra. I think I haven't looked at the metrics recently, and obviously, like, both 2020 and 2021 are very special years for us, and people don't travel much these days. I'm not sure why, but I think it's hard to give you an aggregate number, because the different countries we operate in are in very different stages of maturity from our perspective. And so, for instance, like, France and Spain are profitable by themselves, whereas like Brazil is, we're not like, the user is not paying the platform, and we're still growing the platform, both drivers and passengers, and because we're still in that growth phase, we want to make sure that we remove all friction and just like try to attract like both sides of the marketplace as quickly as possible. So it's impossible to give you just one number. Like overall, like the we're still very much in that investment phase and growing the business and entering new markets. And obviously, like being profitable again is certainly part of the plan. But we won't be there in 2021,
obviously,
in part because of COVID,
obviously.
But also because that's we're still very much in that investment phase.
So, but that means like 10 million plus, I guess, when you are running full speed and when everything, when COVID isn't there and so on.
Okay.
Thanks a lot to our sponsor, the About You Cloud. The About You Cloud offers a full-stack e-commerce solution as a service that runs on exactly the same infrastructure as the About You Shop does. It is mobile-first, can act as headless system, event-driven, can be fully localized, and is super integrated into existing solutions. Besides that, it is designed and developed by a really smart CTO and friend of mine, Sebastian Betz. About You has set up a task force for retailers and brands that want to be quick in the COVID situation. This task force will help you with the launch of your shop, as well as with fulfillment, marketing, support, and internationalization. Simply write to hello@aboutyou.com to be supported by this task force.
And if you look at your tech, then we spoke about boring products, or like products that seem to be boring on the first sight. And if I would look at your product, like just very naive, it's a bit like looking at HelloFresh, for example, where I also would ask, what is the secret sauce? What is the complexity from a tech side? Well, how does it overall look like? What do you do each day? I'd be curious to know more about your secret sauce the secret complexity of your product.
So I think there are two answers to this, and I think both might be interesting. So the first one is, BlaBlaCar grew a lot, kind of like organically and scaling very fast to many countries between 2012 and 2017. And so it was initially built on top of a PHP Symfony monolith. And yes, part of the realization, part of the problem that BlaBlaCar hit in 2017 was like, okay, like, we've scaled too quickly and we're not set up both in terms of like processes, teams, and in terms of this monolith to keep scaling, to keep iterating, to keep innovating on that product. And so we embarked on a kind of like, okay, how are we going to decompose that monolith, make sure that the different parameters of the app are well understood, well maintained, have a team that's dedicated to them, etc. So that's part one, kind of like very much below the surface. We were running on-prem, we migrated to Google Cloud, extra, like we kind of like, we've been revamping the entire product over the past couple of years, kind of like below the surface, trying to avoid like, disturbing our users, but essentially, and the image I use for internally for the company is like, we've been kind of changing pretty much every piece of the airplane while mid-flight. Like, and if I compare 2017 to today, there are still some pieces of the planes that were there 4 years ago, but they're fewer and far between. At some point, maybe there won't be any anymore. And yes, we at no point in time have we stopped like building new features. Have we stopped running the service, etc. So I think that's a huge feat, and I'm super proud of what the team has been doing over those past couple of years. I said there were 2 points. I think there's three actually. Second point, and I mentioned this with the Webus and Busfor acquisitions. Like, we've been evolving from a very carpool centric product to a more multimodal product of like, I want to go from point A to point B. I want to be offered like all the different options, and maybe some of them are cheaper, some of them are more convenient, some of them maybe are more comfortable for me, or leave the departure point at the right time for me, extra. But essentially have that one app that offers you all the possible options. And so that's been quite of a shift too, in terms of like how we think about ourselves, how like what kind of systems we needed to design, evolving what was very much a C2C product, consumer to consumer marketplace product, to a more diverse product where, yes, carpool is still one of our big strengths. It has a lot of very positive effects. But it's just one of the multiple legs that we are operating, and one of the multiple types of supply that we want to provide to our users. So that's two. And the third one is carpool as its own complexity. And we're probably the only one, the only company that's seeing this. But essentially, it's like carpool is interesting but not mind-blowing when it's from a big city to a big city. Like taking a carpool to go from Paris to Lyon, or from Hamburg to Berlin, is not going to as a passenger, I have plenty of other options. Taking a carpool to go from, I know, like a very small city to a different small city, is a very different offering, because they're like, maybe the alternatives are like taking a cab to the nearest train station, taking a first train to the next to this big city, then a high speed train or long distance bus, and then so the alternative is like, okay, I need to change two or three times, and maybe at some point I end up taking much more time, even if I end up taking a train to go from my departure point to my final destination. If I take this alternative compared to if I'm able to find on Blah Car a driver that's doing that exact same trip and that maybe can pick me up like down the street and take me to like within a kilometer of where I'm going, that's completely different. But to do that, you need to have a number of things. You need to have liquidity on your platform, and you need to make it easier for your users to discover some of those trips. And so, for instance, one of the features we've been working on, we call it Smart Stopover. As a driver, I can publish a trip. I can enter what we call manual stopover of like, okay, along the way between Hamburg and Berlin, I know I will be stopping, or I know the highway goes near those cities. So if there are some people that I can pick up or drop off in those cities, like I'm okay for, and I can do that. But even doing that only gets you a very small percentage of the actual possible trips. And so what we started doing is like just looking at the trips that the driver publishes and offering them like trips that and passengers for part of the trips that maybe they didn't had in mind, of like, okay, Tobias would be interested to share your ride on like 60% of the distance from your point of departure to this highway exit. Yes, and it's in the middle of nowhere for you as a driver, but for Tobias, maybe it's very close to where he's going. And so you just need to get off the highway, drop Tobias, and then keep going. And that's kind of the magic of what we're doing. And there are lots of questions of like, okay, how do we price this for the passenger, for the driver? How do we make sure that we optimize the matching so that we can allow more people to travel? So we have a number of interesting like data problem and machine learning problems in terms of like how we operate that marketplace and how we optimize it.
Okay, that sounds interesting. So you also do like multi-stop journeys for passengers, or?
So we try to optimize for a carpool driver. We're going to try to optimize like how many passengers he has and kind of like what we call the fill-up rate of his car. And so typically, like, yes, I've done trips myself as a driver where I was picking up someone, then dropping that person somewhere, and in that same stop, picking up a new person. And Black Car had organized that trip for me. And so it was very easy. Everyone had the same meeting point, extra. So that's the first part. In the long run, yes, we're interested in like offering to the user what we call intermodal trips, like where maybe we would combine like train plus carpool or bus plus carpool. And that's part of the vision we're working towards. But for that, we need to have like strong fundamentals on carpool, on bus, maybe on other types of supply extra. So that's not live yet, but that's something that, yes, we want to work on in the long run.
And you have strong competition with, for example, Tesla entering the market potentially, right? I just read that Elon is planning that this full self-driving mode that they are releasing this year or somehow silently releasing right now is meant to earn extra money for the car owners, right? So that the cars drive themselves through the cities. But it's still, I mean, it's not really a competition because it's short-term trips, but... How do you see that?
Yeah, we'll see how it goes, and I think we have a few years in front of us to be before that vision completely realizes. Yes, you mentioned that. I think the first part of the first segments where it will happen might be more in the city and on short distance trips. But even so, like I think the way we look at this is, we are a marketplace between multiple sources of supply and we have very strong demand that we've been able to attract with the carpool part of the business. So if there's one more source of supply, I think that's still good for us. Like that the people operating that source of supply will be interested in finding passengers, and we can provide those passengers to fill the cars. So let's see, maybe let's meet in a couple of years and see how that has evolved. But we don't see each source of supply as a really direct competition. It's more a question of like, okay, are we able to leverage the different sources of supply, our sources of passengers, and make the best out of it?
Coming back to, let's say, the rocky tech stuff. So you mentioned that you've been on Symfony, I think, and PHP. Did that change? I mean, do you have like one global tech for all the different entities that you acquired? Everything is integrated and all the users are imported into the BlaBlaCar user database, I guess. And what is it based on? Is it like you mentioned that you go away from having the central monolith? Does it then mean that everything is written in different languages? How does the stack look like? How did that change?
So we're migrating over time to a Java services stack, Java, Spring Boot, pretty boring stuff, I'd say. But for that kind of thing, I think boring is fine. This is an interesting conversation because I think there's a sweet spot between forcing all the teams to just use one tool because that's the tool you've invested in, even though maybe for some teams it might not be the best tool to do their job. And at the other extreme of the spectrum, there's like, no, like every team chooses whatever they want, and then you end up operating kind of a jungle of different technologies. Well, obviously, both extremes are bad, and so that's why I was like, okay, what's the sweet spot? I think it depends on the company you're operating. I think for BlaBlaCar specifically, what I've been pushing is more of like, okay, let's make sure we have a strong default, which in this case is like Java Spring Boot. It doesn't mean that other things are forbidden and that you shouldn't use them. But if you do, you need to have a good reason. You need to have thought this through of like, okay, what are the advantages? What are the benefits of using that new technology? But also what are the drawbacks? And I think if as an individual contributor, I look at the problem I'm solving And say like, okay, I want to use Python, for instance, because I'm doing a lot of machine learning and it will make it easier for me to test my models extra. You might be over-indexing on the short-term benefits of like, hey, and the shortest term is probably the engineer saying like, hey, I already know Python, so I'm going to be more efficient in Python, so I'm going to use Python. But even there are longer-term drawbacks of like just internal mobility. This is something I've been pushing a lot in my team of like, after 2 years in a team, like as an engineer, you have a lot of value in going to a new team and applying what you've seen is in your first team, applying maybe tools, maybe processes, maybe your knowledge of the system, as opposed to either staying in that team at some point, feeling bored and wanting a new challenge and leaving the company. So I've been pushing that quite a bit. But for that to work, you need to have kind of like a common ground of like, yes, I know that if I move to that other team, I'm not completely changing processes, tools, technology, language, extra, to make that realistic. And so, again, like if I look at this with my CTO hat, I think I see those benefits, which maybe teams don't see immediately and take some time to emerge, but they're very real. And so that's why I'm like, we have strong defaults. If you want to deviate from them and you want to use like a different set of technologies, let's talk about it. And again, it's not like it's forbidden. It's more like, okay, let's have a conversation about like both short-term but also long-term benefits and drawbacks, because there's a lot of it. Those are long-term choices. Like once you have like 20% of your stack written in Go and 10% in Ruby and the rest in Java, like you're not going to write it. And so this is something that you will have to live with and maintain in the long run. So let's make sure that we think this through when we're making those choices. It's easy to see the very short-term benefits, but let's make sure we have the long view. And again, like this goes back to like kind of like the discipline and how like the right decisions over many years compound into something good. So trying to communicate this to my engineers and to my teams in terms of like how we're thinking about those choices.
So I think it's also about coming up with a vision board and stuff like that in a very early stage, so that everyone knows about the vision and understands it, right?
So that's interesting, because I think that's something I realized joining Blackar. At Apple, like you're part of a huge team and there is already a very strong vision from like the company, but also from your leaders. I mentioned Craig Federighi, extra. And so as an engineering manager, you don't have to, I would say, like exercise those muscles, vision and communication. Whereas obviously joining Blackar as CTO, that was part of the job. And so it took me a while. I think I had initially kind of the engineering bias of like, if I'm doing a good job and I know where I'm going, like people will follow me. And it took me a bit of time to think about it differently, especially in terms of like, okay, I want to make sure that people understand not just the next step, but the overall vision, because in the course of their day, in the course of the engineering decision that they are making every day, when they write a PR, when they review code, like they might be making those tiny architecture decisions. And if I'm not clear with them on like where we're going long-term, then they might deviate from that. And so like kind of like assembling that vision, digesting it and communicating it in a way that can be helpful and actionable for the teams, I think is an important part of the role. And it's probably a part of the role that I started doing later on, as I realized that this was important and it made a big difference. And being able to communicate clearly that vision was key to in my role.
And for long-term planning, do you simply have a roadmap, or Do you do something like OKRs, or what is your take on that?
What do you call long term?
Well, 2 years, I think. That's what you said, yeah.
So that's something I'm not satisfied with, and that's something we're still working on. I think it's easy to have a clear like 5 year vision. Everyone knows what they're going to be working in the next 3 months or 6 months. And so we do quarterly roadmaps, but typically people have a bit more visibility and they know what's around the corner. I think where it's harder and where like it, again, this is part of my job, but this is like, okay, how do you make sure that those quarterly roadmaps, one after the other, are like taking you to that 5 year vision, and that you're not deviating, that you're going fast enough, and if not, like what kind of decision do you need to make, either like in terms of staffing, in terms of reprioritizing extra, and that like kind of like, okay, what do I want to do in 2021, what do I want to do in 2022, those discussions aren't that easy, because typically like the what is not clear. Like you don't have product specs. Like there's a lot of like discovery that needs to happen, design specs, extra. And so I think the first reaction from any engineer is like, no, I can't scope this. I have no idea whether it's going to take me like a week or a month or a quarter. And so I think there's a question of like, okay, how do you have those discussion in a constructive way of like, okay, are we on track or not? Are we able to not scope this in details, but like hand wave, like, okay, this is about like a quarter of work for this team. This is about like extra, and like having those order of magnitudes is hard, but I think it's important to have the right, those conversations in a constructive way when you look at like 1-2 years down the road.
Okay. I think one important technique to look at is also product discovery, right? Where Marty Kagan says that 90% of the companies do it wrong, like just doing very early prototypes and user testing with tools like Figma, like just qualitative testing internally and externally with users. Are you doing something like that? Because, I mean, your product would be perfect fit for that, right?
We do a lot of things. So I'm not the best person to talk about this. And I work hand in hand with Rémi Guyot, which is our CPO, and we developed a great relationship. I really enjoyed working with Rémi and his teams. But essentially like, yes, so they've developed what they call a product development framework with a number of steps of like, okay, we're going to, I think it starts with like Amazon style with the PR. Like, okay, if we were to roll this out to the world, like what would we say about it? What would we, how would we put the spotlight on that? It goes on, and I'm probably going to mix the order, but it's like, okay, benchmark, what are other similar companies that are operating marketplaces like us? What do they do to solve that problem? Okay, what are the metrics we want to move, and what would be success for this project, extra. And it goes on to like, okay, user research, testing the kind of like early designs, implement, having the full spec, implementing that spec, extra. And so we try to be, organized and again, like discipline about that of like, okay, let's do it step by step. And at any point in time, in at any of those steps, there are clear deliverable of like, okay, what's the benchmark with similar companies, or what is the actual press release that you've written, so that everyone can follow the progress and see, okay, this is, I understand what problem we're trying to solve. I have all the information I need to, for instance, as an engineer, to make sure that I'm going to scope this properly, extra. So we do a lot of that. We, depending on the type of project, we do guerrilla testing in the different countries we operate. We do user research, and that's something that's been super interesting to watch. So we, for instance, like, okay, we're going to be testing this new feature with users from Russia. And so we have a Slack channel where we publish those and where everyone can follow. They're translated live. So, and everyone is following them in English, like the user saying like, I understand, what is this? Or, hey, oh, this is smart. Or, hey, I like that. So having that kind of very direct, like seeing the users with your playing with your product and having that immediate feedback, emotions, reactions is always super interesting to watch. I wish I had more time to watch more of those, but every time I've joined some of them, it's been very interesting and very insightful. Like, and then what do you make out of those very specific data points? Is there something completely broken about what you designed because the users don't understand it, or is it more like, okay, there's a specific case that we haven't covered? Like, how do you take that and then reincorporate that in your product, in your designs?
So two interesting pieces. So you do that product discovery in Slack, really. So the user service in Slack, and people can just watch it, or?
So we organize user research sessions where we bring users in our offices, for instance, in Moscow or in Kiev.
Yeah.
They'll be filmed. They know they're filmed. And that is transmitted live. And we have a Slack channel where everyone can feel like, okay, next session is this day. This is what we're going to be testing. This is what we're trying to learn extra. And so that part is public to the company and is broadcasted and can be joined. And so not obviously, like, we don't want 700 people like watching this every time there's one, but it allows for more transparency and for the engineers, for instance, or for teams that are impacted by the new features that being tested. I think it's always interesting to have that ability. It doesn't mean that, again, that all of the engineers are joining those sessions, but it makes it possible, and it triggers the right conversations when people are joining those, and it's an interesting thing to watch as a builder. Like, watch your users, like, hands on with the product. I think maybe that's also my Apple pass. There's like, that's one thing I really liked when I was working at Apple, is like, you constantly see people using your product, and so I was constantly watching over people's shoulder of like, oh, interesting. So you did this to do this, or oh, do you know you can do this? Oh no, I didn't know. Or like, okay, how do you make those features more discoverable? Because maybe especially on iOS, like, you don't have tooltips, you don't have, and so it's easy for users to miss a feature. Sorry, I'm getting off track there, but yeah, I think that's something that I've always been fascinated by, like, as a builder, seeing users use your product. That's very much part of myself at this point, and I would have a hard time joining a company that would be only B2B. I think I'd miss the consumer angle and the, hey, I know the product you're working on.
And the PR aspect, so the press release aspect, that is essentially something that Amazon does, right?
Yeah. Sorry, I mentioned. Yeah, I think, and I don't know if they're still doing that. But at some point, yes, they've. That was part of like kind of how Amazon was doing projects and starting from, okay, what story do you want to tell the user? And so starting a project was that press release, and so we've stolen that from them.
I still have one question that I think is really important, or a few questions that I think are very important. But one thing I particularly like is the three things you recently learned that you would recommend to every CTO out there.
I think I know how recent it needs to be, but I think one thing I've learned in the past 2 years is how important it is to write. And I started pushing that at Blackhawk before COVID, before we all started working remotely. And obviously it took a different taste once everyone was working from home, but like, the ability for an engineer to write clearly and express their thoughts and convince in a way that's is both clear and convincing, I think, is something that we underestimate. And it pulls a lot of things. It pulls like, do you understand a problem, and have you digested it enough that you are able to in one pager or a couple pages, like I'm not talking about like 10, 20 pages, but just like, are you able to do a clear and short problem statement? Here are the alternatives we considered, and here's why we're going with this one. Not in slides, like a boring Google Doc. I think that's something that is super important as an engineering leader. And I think writing has this kind of like superpower where if you're not clear yourself what exactly you're trying to solve or why this is the right solution, it's going to like appear very clearly when you try and write it in that format. It might not, if you're hand waving in a live conversation, it might not appear that clearly if you have slides. And I think it's much easier to kind of like mask that maybe gaps in your understanding, gaps in your logic in slides. Whereas if it's written black on white in a one or two pages, I think it's always very illuminating to me of like, okay, yeah, this is clear. I know exactly, and I can get behind this. Or, okay, I understand that part, but this part, like, I'm not sure. Like, okay, let's dig into this. So writing very much is the first one. And what I so that's writing to communicate to other people, but I've also seen that writing makes you think. Like, writing helps you being clear with yourself. And again, in a way that live conversation could help, but then like doesn't fix those ideas. And so I've been pushing a lot of that. And again, like if you want fewer meetings or if you want fewer Zoom conversations, like being able to write, being able to prepare beforehand, I think makes also any meeting more efficient, because at that point you know exactly from where you're starting, as opposed to people like just discovering your ideas because in the meeting. So again, like yes, writing. We are getting to a point where for leadership roles in the engineering organization, we started doing writing exercise more than coding exercise, but like, okay, this is a situation like, kind of a case of like, okay, write a one pager of like how to drive to a decision. So we'll see. We're still experimenting with that, but yeah, writing is certainly the first one. I think the second one, and this is something I've been working quite a bit on, and that I think you had Jason, the CEO of GitHub, recently on the podcast, and I saw him putting it on the slide in a talk he did in December. But it's like I think the way the slide was phrased was like, honest introspection is the best superpower for everyone everywhere, but especially as a leader, yes, I think being able to look at yourself and say like, okay, here's what I'm doing well. Here's where I need to get better at. Why is that topic hard for me to work on? Or why is that behavior in this teammate making me cringe? Why, like, you know, like some managers have this like user manual of like, okay, here's what you need to know about me if you're going to report to me. I've seen quite a few people, and my first reaction was to that was like, there's one part that I found real interesting was like setting expectations, like this is what I expect from you. That's great. I think the part was like, hey, you should know that if you talk about this, this is how I'm going to react. I'm less convinced, because I'm like, okay, as the leader, as the manager, I should know exactly why maybe this is making me cringe or why this is making me mad and why I'm reacting like that. And that takes like introspection and a deep understanding of like, okay, what happens if there's a someone disagreeing with me violently, or what happens if someone is late? Why is that making me mad? Extra, like being able to articulate not just like, hey, I'm going to be mad, but here's why I find this unacceptable and here's why I have those expectations, I think is super important. And it's kind of like continuous improvement, but for yourself, like being, and you can only do that if you understand in depth why you're behaving like you do, and on what button to push to change that if you're not satisfied with your own behavior.
Very good answer. I like it. then one thing I tend to do is asking people for favorite tools, because asking people for book, I somehow got sick of leadership books. So do you have any favorite tool, anything nerdy that you want to share or not too nerdy that you want to share?
I'm currently looking into spaced repetition systems. So systems where if you want to learn something by heart, you have like small apps. Anki is one of them, where you essentially enter like what you're trying to learn, and then it will ask you those questions and then re-ask them like a couple of days later and then 1 week later. And so because it's been shown, like research has shown that that's the right way to kind of like ingrain something in your long-term memory. And so this is a topic that fascinates me, both as, of course, as a parent when I see my kids learning at school, but also for myself when I'm like, okay, I need, for instance, like I'm going to present something to the board of Blackar. I want to know those numbers about the business by heart. How am I going to learn them? And again, like I'm happy to commit to that to my long-term memory, because like I'll need to remember them in the long run. So using those tools is something that I'm experimenting with right now. It feels to me like, especially when you look at how kids learn today, there's kind of a lost opportunity to use kind of that research that's been happening in the past couple of years of like, this is how you learn something for the long run, and not just like learning the day before the exam, passing the exam, but then like 6 months later, you completely forgot everything. Seems like we in 2021, we should be able to do better than that.
Okay, thanks. I still have a little surprise for you. When I was preparing for this podcast, I actually signed up using your app and installed it, and it looks quite nice, by the way. And I just tried to enter 2005 in California as a destination. And I actually found a driver named Marty McFly on your platform with a DeLorean DMC-12. And we now can just order him and have a coffee with Marty and then have a rocky ride into your past when you just started at Apple. And we now have the chance to observe you for a while. I think you were working as just started as lead engineer back then. And you now have the unique chance to whisper something into young Olivier's ears. What would it be?
That's a tough one. I know, maybe something about at Apple, I change kind of jobs or roles or kind of project I was working on every 18 months to 2 years. And so there was actually a lot of learning, but at the time I didn't realize that was the case. It was more like, okay, we finished this release, moving on. I think there's something about like, you only realize how much you've been learning once you're able to step back and look at like that accumulation. And so I know like maybe there's something about like, okay, finding the time and creating the space to kind of step back and look at what's been happening to you, not just on the last week basis, but more like over the past 2 years, what did I learn? What did I, what are my sources of frustration? And how do I, again, like, how do I go about it? What do I do so that I keep enjoying the parts I enjoy, I fix the parts I don't enjoy, and maybe this is like talking with my boss, maybe this is just like changing how I behave on a day-to-day basis. And so this, I guess this goes back to like what we were just discussing, to like introspection and creating the space for that. Yeah, as a leader, I think this is even more important because it's easy to get caught in the day-to-day and just like grinding in the machine and like, oh my God, I'm always late to the next meeting, or there's always something that I need to do for tomorrow, for next week. And so how do you kind of like create that space, which doesn't need to be like 5 hours per week? It could be like, okay, every month I'm going to just like block 2 hours to kind of like look back through my notes, like look at what's been happening and kind of like step back, kind of like step out of my usual self and make sure that I'm not just forgetting the long-term view or long-term ambition. Where do I want to go? I think that's something that I would tell everyone, but probably younger Olivier even more.
Okay, good. So start reflecting early.
Yeah.
I like that. I like that. I actually like that you are like a very reflective person and a lot into introspecting. I hope we can catch up on this podcast. So thanks a lot for being with me, and I hope the situation in Paris gets better soon. So next time I come to Paris, I call you and we can have a wine at Le Baron Rouge, which is my favorite spot in Paris. I don't know if you know that.
happy to do that.
Okay. Thanks a lot. And thanks a lot for your insights. Talk to you soon.
Thank you, Tobias. Thanks for having me.
Thanks again to our sponsors, Fastly and the About You Cloud. If you want to know more about Fastly services, simply visit fastly.com/alphalist. If you want to get in touch with About You and hear more about the About You Cloud, simply write to hello@aboutyou.com. Thanks a lot.